Welcome to Building 72, the podcast brought to you by the Entertainment Arts and Engineering Program at the University of Utah. Thank you for joining your hosts, Adam Hunter and Corinne Lewis, to talk about the video game industry and, you know, probably other stuff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Building 72. I'm laughing. You might hear my voice laughing because we're already having such a good time. So I'm happy that you're all here. And we is me, Corinne Lewis. And I am here with my intrepid co-host, Adam Hunter.
You said intrepid. And for a second, I thought you said it, my interrupted co-host. And I was like, oh, does that mean I like speak out of turn? I'm sorry. No. I'll be quiet.
That is, we are recording on a Friday and we are salty and punchy and it's
because
exciting.
This is how we work.
And this is the perfect day for my dear friend, Greg. To be here.
Saltiest, right?
Yes. No. So, I don't even know where to start because we've known each other for so long. So, Greg, will you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So, my name is Greg Bayless. I am Associate Director of the Therapeutic Games and Apps Lab at the University of Utah, where I develop medical apps and games and research tools. I also own an indie studio called Starbox Games, and I'm developing a drag queen brawler called Super Bearded Dragons, and it's all sorts of campy, glittery glory. So I'm excited to talk about kind of all of that and my journey as an indie and a game developer. And
yeah. You know, it's funny because I was thinking about this earlier today. I feel like you probably told me when you started in our program so many years ago, why, like what drew you to games? But I feel like I don't remember what, so can you tell us, remind
me? Yeah, that's kind of a funny story because I wasn't one of those kids who like grew up dreaming of becoming a game developer. I was a hard sciences major in college and then eventually ended up with an English literature degree and studied languages and things like that. But as I was, studying narrative and the hero's journey and things like that, video game narratives kept coming up. And anything I would write about traditional literature would get, you know, lost in the internet submission process and I would never hear about it again. And anything I would write about video game stories, they would literally get back to me like in 1 or 2 days and say, we want to publish this and we're ready to go. And this is so exciting. And so I started writing more and more about video game narratives. And then my friend, Paul Bills, who actually, you know, came to the program as well.
I do.
Said, hey, you're spending a lot of time thinking about games. Why don't you just go into game design, you know? And so it was late February. I thought, well, there's no way graduate admissions are still open. It was February 25th. I go online and sure enough, applications are open until the 28th. And so I had 3 days to prepare my whole application. And then literally on March 3rd, so 3 days after that, I got an email saying that I was accepted and they wanted me to come. And so I found out about the EAE program, applied and was admitted within 1 week.
Wow, that, I don't think I remembered that. That's funny, that's hilarious. And that email would have been from me. So
yeah.
Well, I suppose it's possible it was Hallie then, but.
So at that point I said, well, I guess if I'm gonna get a master's degree in games, I should probably know something about how to make them. And so I spent the next, 6 months as I was finishing off my undergraduate degree and then the summer before EAE, really learning Game Maker and trying to dive into pixel art. And it's just been a gradual process since then. I'm self-taught, so I learned how to code on YouTube, and same for pixel art. Like I had used Photoshop before, but kind of jumped in with more gusto, trying to understand how to make characters and how to animate them, and have just been learning and failing a lot and improving little by little over time.
Well, I think that's. I didn't remember that it was a week. I remembered was fast. And Paul is pretty persuasive sometimes.
Yeah.
So you said you never like had aspirations to be a game developer. Did you at least like play a lot of games when you were younger? Do you have a video game history?
Yeah, I mean, growing up? I played lots of video games when I was younger. When I was a teenager, I fiddled around a lot in the Warcraft 3 World Editor, which is where like the modern day MOBA came from, you know, stuff like that. But actually during college, I swore off video games. I was like, oh, they're too big of a waste of time. I'm in 6 lit classes a semester reading 400 pages a night. So there's just no way I can play video games, right? And then it was the, you know, again, the study of narrative that kind of got me back into that. And I started off just like watching video games again. My first playthrough of The Last of Us was on YouTube, you know, and I just watched the whole game. But, you know, kind of diving into these newer, interesting stories, you know, with dynamic characters and queer representation and things like that really helped me to find a new appreciation for video games. And that got me really invested again to where I was playing. And now I'm addicted to, you know, Ark, Survival Evolved, and League of Legends, like Days of Old. So it's all good.
Yeah, there was a huge contingent of C5s that played League so loud in the lab.
Well, I was going to say that the trick to a literature class is someone, I have an English degree, not an English literature degree, but the key to all the literature classes is you just don't read 400 pages a night. You just go to Wikipedia and that gets you 50% of the way there.
And Greg was a good student.
Oh, I didn't know we were talking about good student things. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, I love reading too. I mean, a lot of times people think game developers are, you know, it's just coders or whatever, but like game developers come from all sorts of crazy backgrounds. And I would say their biggest like commonality is curiosity, right? And so for some people that means reading a ton, and others that means playing a ton of games. But I feel like everyone sort of draws on a pretty eclectic background, you know, as they come into games, which I think also makes for a lot more interesting games.
Yeah. Well, you're doing, I mean, you have had just a very eclectic, but I just think the coolest, I mean, you have a really cool day job. Yeah. And you also teach for us. So you are getting games like 360, like you are seeing every facet of games. You know, you play AAA games, you make indie games, you like help people make serious games, and you teach our students how to make little baby games. You know, it's like, level. Mm-hmm. It's like games. I hope you're still reading.
Yeah. Sometimes about games, sometimes. Right?
And you speak Russian, so that's...
I do. I'm learning Turkish and Korean right now.
No.
Just because I'm weird.
That's been my pandemic thing, is I'm learning Spanish, so.
Yeah.
Well, now I feel like I'm underprepared for this conversation. Oh. I've been learning how to speak two-year-old. Like, does that count?
Yeah, I mean, that's its own entire... branch of languages.
Yeah, that's called psychology and reverse psychology.
Well, no, but it's like it's like a puzzle where you have to interpret, like, did she just say an S or did she say a T, but her mouth doesn't know how to make the S shape? So
that sounds like playtesting.
Seriously. So I want to talk, I mean, there's 10,000 things to talk to you about. I want to talk really quickly. We had Roger on the podcast a while ago and he gave us everything about serious games and everything like that. But I kind of want your take on it, because my understanding is that he has a much kind of like higher level overseer type role, whereas you're the one who's in the trenches with everybody getting everything done. So could you talk about what do you do up at the Gap Lab and how do you spend your days?
Well, I spend my days in lots of meetings. You know, originally when I started at the Gap Lab, I was a producer. And so I was over a couple of different projects that were working to help people improve their medication adherence. But I found that as a producer, I was most useful when I was jumping in and, you know, helping out with the code or tracking down assets or whatever. I was just sort of filling in the gaps. And I would say that role has kind of continued on as a project manager and now as associate director. It's really about assessing, you know, what are the strengths of a specific team and where can I augment that? In terms of my work with Roger, that means that I picked up, you know, some of the grant writing and some of the budget writing and things like that. I don't necessarily know what my job's going to look like any single day, because every new project is a new partner with new domains of expertise that we have to sort of develop. But what that means is that I get to collaborate with a lot of wicked smart people in solving cool problems. And I get to come to kind of a new job every day, which I actually really like. You know, I'm not the kind of person who can like sit at the same 9 to 5, like answering phones or something like that. And so it's really great for me to be able to kind of explore all of these different topics and try to find new ways of solving them. As far as working with, you know, the graduate students, like we do stand-ups every day and kind of check out different tasks, but kind of my big role is as almost like a product owner. And so I'll meet with them regularly and make sure that we're moving towards our milestones. I do design sessions with the students and build reviews and things like that. But really it's just marching the project along, interfacing with project partners and administrators to make sure that we're kind of meeting their expectations. And then also managing kind of the financing and hiring and things like that, making sure that we have funding to pay the students, making sure that they're taken care of as far as you know, insurance goes and tuition benefits. So it's kind of a mixture of a lot of different things, but I still get to be elbows deep in the, you know, like in the actual code or in the art assets, like helping out and designing some of those features.
That's really fascinating.
I do not think there could have been a better person for that job than you. Like, you're just the perfect person for that job.
Perfect combination of ADHD and anxiety to succeed in that role.
I think sometimes that's a benefit for producers, for sure.
Do you find when it comes to working with grad students, is making serious games or making games that have kind of much more rigorous, because like at grad school, it's like, make whatever you want. The only guidelines is that it has to be a mobile game or whatever. But I imagine some of the people you're dealing with is like, no, we have to achieve this very, very specific goal through this set of parameters. Do you find that is it hard to get the students into that mindset or do they adapt really well into the like freeform thinking versus kind of more tight-knit structured organizational thinking?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I actually think constraints make it easier to design, right? And some of those medical considerations, you know, like for example, we develop games and apps for geriatric patients. And that means that we have to take certain considerations into account. There are only certain types of gestures that we can use consistently. You know, you have to have font sizes that are a certain size and certain colorations to make sure that they're legible. And that actually drives the creativity, I think. There is a little bit of adoption time where people are sort of getting used to this idea of like, okay, fun sometimes takes the second seat to accessibility or to function or whatever. But I find that a lot of students really enjoy the structure in the sense that there's a much more concrete timeline, there's a much more concrete goal. You know, success looks a little bit different in medical games than it does in traditional games, because you're not trying to, you know, sell millions and millions of copies. You're trying to have a dramatic impact in one person's life, you know, and if that ends up being the case, then you've succeeded. And that, I mean, it feels really great to know that you're helping people, you know. We have projects that help with geriatric depression and phantom limb pain and, you know, lower spinal cord injury and all sorts of things like that. And I find that the kids really get invested in that mission of helping people, and it shows in their design work. Mm-hmm. In fact, maybe I'll regret saying this, but I actually think that the work that the students do on the GAP projects is a lot of times better quality than the work they do on their personal projects. And part of that I understand is that the EAE studio, there's drama, there's, you know, there's complex relationships that they're managing. And so executing on a unified vision is a lot harder than when there's like a concrete funding source, concrete partner, concrete person who says yes or no to things.
Well, yeah, Roger always says it's not about the games, it's about the learning, right? So it's a very different thing when you're actually like promising to create something for somebody. But I 100% agree. It's like the best, my favorite poetry is metered poetry. Like constraints really can create a lot of creativity.
And so now we have to do the rest of the podcast in troche.
Oh God. Okay. I was just going to say, I might be able to do limerick.
Oh, I don't mind that.
There once was a developer named Greg.
Right.
Who helped people rehabilitate their legs. Oh, see, we're getting there.
Got to bring Nantucket into it somewhere though, right?
So you talked earlier about, having that curiosity and everything like that. Is that what drove you, not drove you, is that what led you to kind of like indie development on your own, was just wanting to create more and wanting to explore different things and different stories and different spaces and everything like that? Or how did that indie side kind of work its way into your life?
Yeah. I was a creative writer while I was going through my English lit degree, took a lot of creative writing classes and was writing poetry. And I've always loved creating things. And so I don't think in my mind, it was ever a question of like, will I create things in the future? It was, what form is that creation going to take? I had originally thought about like going into screenplay writing or something like that, but decided that the future was media rich and that I was going to kind of go down that road. And so really for me, the dream of indie is being able to tell your own stories in your own way. And to, to make sort of smaller niche games that are going to matter to a very specific audience. I think there's something really beautiful, like even in like handwritten notes to another person. And I think a lot of times when we think about games, we think about these big expensive productions. And I went through this phase where I was making little 6-hour games. Like I would spend a total of 6 hours making a game for someone for their birthday. And it was a handwritten, I love you, it was kind of that equivalent. One of the ideas that I really like as far as games go is like just games, I don't know, we take games too seriously sometimes. We need them to make us $1 million. We need them to turn us into the next John Blow. We put so much pressure on them. And so one of the ideas that I teach in my class is like, let this game be your friend. Don't expect your friend to pay for your meals. Don't expect your friend to take you places. Accept your friend as they are, enjoy them, follow the fun, let them be who they want to be. And I think that's when games are the best and the most interesting. I love doing game jams and just little quick one-off projects. And I remember one time my friend, who's not a game developer, reached out to me and he said, "Hey, well, I've always been interested in making games, but I have no idea where to start." And there happened to be a game jam that weekend. And so I said, "Well, how about you come and we'll spend 12 hours and we'll make a game together." And it was just me and him. No one else, but we ended up with this really cute experience that we both just cared so much about and loved. And it became a huge point of connection,
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
That's such good advice, Greg. That's such good advice because, we get students all the time, Adam, I'm sure you hear this too, is that, like they come in and they want to be game designers, but they don't really know what a game designer is. But really what they want to do is be a creative director, which is like years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And I always say, you can be whatever you want, but recognize that that takes time and it takes effort. And in the meantime, you got to keep making games. So don't be so attached. Don't be so attached. It's the same problem. I mean, you guys know, you're English majors like me, the great American novel, everybody wants to write that. And everybody's got, or people have it in their drawer and they never do anything with it because they've put too much of themselves in it. So it's not an art piece. It's like an extension of them. And I feel like that's happening with games but games are visual, so you can see people, so they're even more afraid. I don't know. It's such an interesting world we live in right now.
Yeah. I just remember I had this one friend who was a prolific poet and would write all sorts of really bad poetry. It was so, so, so bad. My other friend and I, whenever he would do a recitation, it would take all of our energy to not like just bust up laughing. It was such poorly written poetry, you know. But that was like, for us, that was a beautiful experience to see him making bad poetry. Right. You know, I wish we felt more comfortable making bad games, you know. Oh, this is a crappy game that I made in 4 hours and it has all sorts of bugs and problems, but it's mine, you know? I'm creative director of this thing, of this very small thing.
Yeah, that's what I always say is, well, you know, you can do that job. You'll just have to start your own company.
Yeah.
Maybe bad advice.
Well, a lot of people think of game designers as creative directors, but the reality is most game designers spend a ton of time in Excel balancing like virtual economies or, you know, buffs for different characters.
Yes.
Like you look at a patch update for League of Legends, and what those designers have been doing is tweaking numbers and then sending it to QA. They're not like a lot of times coming up with huge, you know, changes to the system.
It's all min-maxing it after it, like it comes out and it's just like, little teeny adjustments.
There was a designer on a team that I worked with. He's very, very talented and very great at what he does, but probably 90% of his job was just like content management, like because it was an online game. And so it's like, okay, these items are going in, this is how much they cost, these items are going out, these ones are marked as rare, these ones are da 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 da. And like you said, like knee deep in spreadsheets all day, every day, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the things that my freshman students, when they first like hear any of the things that we've done with designers, they always talk about I'm writing, or even the writers, you know, like when they talk to Adam, like I'm writing in a spreadsheet. I am not writing the great American novel. And they're like, they just, I mean, you know, it looks like it's opaque, right? Until you get under the hood and then you can see how it all works together. And that is pretty shocking sometimes, you know?
So, yeah.
As you know, game development is a shocker at every turn, it seems like.
Yeah, you never know what you're getting yourself into, even after you've been doing it for years and years.
It's kind of part of the fun.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. My current project, Bearded Dragons, like, it initially started out at like I was planning on doing a 3-week prototype and then throwing it up on itch.io, mm-hmm. you know, and so I never had plans. Like I would have never conceived that almost 3 years later I would still be working on it, you know, but I built that first little prototype and people said, oh, this is kind of fun, you should keep doing this. And so then I did another month of development and some, you know, people were still asking about it, and so it just kind of gradually grew. Like I still, maybe a year in, I still didn't know if I would finish it or if this would just be a little foray and a thought experiment. But I ended up taking it to the Smithsonian American Art Museum for their arcade. So that's in Washington, DC. And again, I didn't know what I was getting myself into, but I show up and there are 24,000 people there. And they've selected 12 or 14 games that are all about diversity. And so I'm there with trans developers and Muslim developers and just, you know, people with really interesting perspectives on life and sort of getting to know them. And then there's 24,000 people that come through over the 2-day period who are, you know, talking about the game and saying, when's this being released? I want to play it. And so that was the first moment where I was like, okay, maybe this could be somewhere, you know? I knew at that point that I was going to finish it. I still don't know when exactly that will be, you know, and that's 2 years after that. But yeah. I knew at that point that this was something that was worth pursuing on a longer term basis. Mm-hmm. You know, they say the hardest thing ever about, I mean, whether it's writing or making a game is just finishing your first big project.
Absolutely. You know,
getting the rough draft done, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to have clay to work with, right? So you have to get a lot of stuff out there so you can, you know, trim and edit. And, you know, that's the same for games, right? Well, so let's see. How long has it been since you did the Kickstarter? Is it
Kickstarter was in November of last year.
Okay. Well, pandemic brain land. I don't remember anything about 2020.
Yeah, last year was one really, really long day that just it never felt like stopped.
It was Wednesday and Sunday on repeat or something. So weird.
Yeah. So,
the Kickstarter was hard.
Yeah, I mean, well, Kickstarters are always hard, right? They kind of warn you beforehand that it's going to be a full-time job and all of that. I think going into it, I thought there would be this like magical bump at the start that would like buoy me up and make me feel super excited. And there was that for a couple days, but I feel like I didn't really have enough of a following beforehand. And it's so hard to gauge those anyway. I was posting things on Reddit or, you know, other places, and sometimes they would get 1,000 upvotes or whatever. And so you think, oh, if 1,000 people think it's cool, then, you know, maybe there's a market for that. But also just hosting a Kickstarter during a pandemic when everyone's feeling a little bit financially insecure. And I don't know, there were lots of factors that went into it. I guess for clarification, the Kickstarter wasn't funded, you know, which is hard. But I think that also forced me to be a little bit more critical about what I was wanting to do with the game too. I think in some ways I was growing tired of working on it and I wanted an influx of capital so I could just get it done and, you know, move on to my next thing. And I think with it not being funded, I had to have a really hard conversation with myself about like, okay, even if this doesn't make money, is it still worth it to keep going? You know, I'm able to live comfortably on my day job salary. You know, I'm not dependent on my game to be able to make money. Obviously, I'd be fine if I made.
Wouldn't that be great? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Had to buy a mansion or something.
Darn.
You know, but it forced me to sort of say, no, this is something I care about, whether there's money attached to it or not. You know, and there's this whole notion of like sunk costs and all that. Well, okay, I had put some money into it, but I mean, the thing I value most from the experience of making the game is actually those contacts that I made at the Smithsonian Arcade.
That's also
funny, but like, you know, you meet some of the coolest people who just like change your perspective on life and set you on a different trajectory. And I think for me, the game has been much more about community than anything else. You know, I have been able to get involved with the local queer film festival here in Salt Lake City. I've gotten involved with the DIY Fest and Craft Lake City, you know, who are promoting, they're doing an awesome job of promoting local artisans and crafts. I've gotten to go to a bunch of different conferences and show it off and just met some of the coolest people as well. And I think it's hard to think about a game without thinking about the community around it, you know? And I had almost thought, oh, community is the thing that happens on Reddit and the thing that happens on Steam and the thing that happens on Twitch, you know? But in actuality, the community that was happening all around me. And I had all sorts of people supporting me the whole time, you know? But it was just in different ways than I had really been prepared to think about. You know, I had all sorts of people come out of the woodworks to try to support the Kickstarter, even who I would have never expected to, you know, a poetry journal that I submitted to 3 or 4 years ago, did a promo of my game. They wanted it to succeed, you know, all sorts of funny stuff like that.
Oh, that's so great. I love hearing that because, I mean, I did back it. I'm still willing to give you my money if you want it. And I, you know, it's like, it's such a hard thing. It's like Kickstarter has a little bit more foundational reputation, but like the GoFundMes and the Indiegogos and the, like, it's so hard to decide how to do that. And I have students ask me all the time and I'm like, well, are you going to fulfill if you don't make the money you think you should? And they're like, no. And I'm like, then that's Kickstarter for you. I don't think that's why you did it, but I just, I think you're right about the community. You know, it's like an art project, right? It's like you write a novel, you hope it touches people and you hope that people read it. I mean, that's why we do these outward expressions or we would just paint and leave it in the garage or something, I guess. I don't know what else we would do. So I'm working on something right now and I'm like, I'm at the point where I just want everybody to look at it because I want that feedback, which is weird. because it's not like I'm, I don't know. It's weird in pandemic land. It's all weird.
You know, but like at the same time, I don't know. One of the things that gets in the way of game designers really getting their games out there is being afraid that it's like not ready for prime time, you know, like, oh, people will think it's dumb or my art's bad or whatever. And that's been hard for me. I mean, I like to control things, you know, I like to feel in control of my public persona and things like that. And you sort of have to let go of that ego and just say, okay, this is where it's at. And, you know, yeah, I'm going to get some like feedback that's less helpful, but, you know, putting it in front of people's eyes is going to give me a better perspective long-term to be able to make it the best product I can, you know? And for me personally, I'm not a great artist, you know? As far as coding goes, I'm self-taught. So my code is spaghetti. You know, if any like trained engineer looked at my code, they would probably be horrified. You know, but I can shine in the way that I know how, you know, I know how to make games. I know how to make kind of crappy art that's goofy. And I know a lot about drag culture and
right.
Come up with awful puns endlessly. And so that's what I'll do. You know,
I like the art on Bearded Dragons, by the way. I really like it a lot. Well, I think it's great. I mean, you have an aesthetic, and that's, I love that about indie games. It's like, it is really an expression of someone, you know? So it's like, yeah, we get to see your heart.
I'm hoping that one of these days, the aesthetic is something a little bit more intentional and a little bit less limited by my...
your Photoshop skills or your Maya or something.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, look at like, you know, like XKCD is a webcomic that's just stick figures because you got to work with what you have.
Yeah. I think the other thing I've realized though, as I've been making games, is a lot of people think of like indie developers as these like solo auteurs who like craft the most beautiful narrative ever and do it all alone. You know, we have all sorts of examples that are sort of played up. So you have Toby Fox with Undertale, but like the thing that people don't realize is even though it says by Toby Fox, like he had someone who did all the art for it.
Yep.
You know? There's not really such a thing as a solo developer. You know, games are collaborative experiences. And even if you do generate all of the code yourself, the engine you built it in was built by someone else. And,
right.
You know, the ideas behind your game and behind the narrative are based on other things. And so I think part of the difficult journey of an indie is getting over your sense of ego in the sense that you have to like make the entire game yourself. You know, it's okay to outsource your music. It's okay to not be good at something and have someone else do it, you know? And the reality is there isn't a game out there that's really made by one person.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah, even like Super Meat Boy, you know, that from Indie Game, the movie, like I always have students watch that movie and you see Phil Fish and, you know, I mean, that game would have been done a lot faster if he had been better at working with other people. So those are the skills I think that no matter what kind of game you're making and that you need, you know, and that's something as a writer that I've realized, and I don't know if you guys feel like this about, you know, being writers, is that I realized that me sitting in my office by myself writing novels was sucking the life out of me. Like I like being around people way too much to be able to express myself only in that very narrow way, you know? And that's what I love about games. That's what I love about teaching actually, is that, you know, I get to talk about narrative crap all the time. And then when I sit down, I've learned, you know, as I've taught, I'm sure you're finding that now that you're teaching for us all the time, you're, you know, it's extending your skill set too. That's what I love about teaching. Yeah. So it's selfish. It's 100% selfish.
Well, I think also, like, if you're going to go into games at, like, with this idea of an auteur or artist or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, that's fine. It's going to take forever.
Well, I mean, that's great. But, like, really what you are in a big sense is an eye to see the world, right? You are collecting experiences and transforming them into something else. And I used to always say when I was doing a lot of poetry that I wanted to live my life in a way where the poetry would just write itself, you know? it's not that like I have any like special thoughts going through my head. It's just that I've interacted with lots of special people and aggregated, you know, their ideas in interesting ways. And I feel like that's how it is with my game as well. Like I've had the fortune of being able to interact with a lot of out, queer, fun, amazing people. And I feel like the different characters in my game are sort of reinterpretations of them, or, you know, recollections of conversations that I've had. And so in that way, even if I don't make $1 million off of the game, I have this beautiful like homage to all these people who I love, and sort of a, I don't know, it's like a receptacle of memories and emotions that is important for me, but I think could also be an important touchstone for other people.
I love that.
Do you find it hard, if you do games all day, do you find it hard to come home and do games at night? Because I know like that was one of the bits of advice I'd always give people. They're like, I want to write a novel. And I was like, okay, well, don't get a job as a writer, because you're going to be writing all day. And the last thing you're going to want to do is come home and sit back in front of your computer for more and more hours. Do you find that there's that burnout, or are there ways to overcome it? Or are you just like, let's do it. Let's games all the time. I'd make games in my sleep if I could.
You know, I mean, for me, games are the one thing that I never grow tired of. Like I go to work and make games. I come home and host a game night with friends. Friends go home at 11 and I work on my game from 11 to 2. Yeah, like it's just nonstop. And I think that's kind of what got me, really made me feel that this was a long-term possibility for a career for me. Just that I knew, you know, I wasn't going to grow tired of it. I think I'm also lucky in the sense that like my day job has different types of games than the games I'm working on at night. But I mean, honestly, my biggest piece of advice for maintaining motivation is just to make it a habit to work on your game. You know, I always say that 1%, like lots of 1% days stack up a lot faster than 10% days do. You know, you fit in 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day, that's fine. That means tomorrow your game's farther along than it was the day before, you know, and that's been a huge mantra for me, because otherwise you always say, oh, I'll wait until I have 5 hours to put towards it, right, or I'll wait until I can complete this entire task all at once. I'm like, well, that's not real life. Like, fit it in where it fits.
I really like that, because that's how I am. I have that bad personality trait of like, if I can't give 100%, then why like give anything, right? Like if I can't start running, then what's even the point? And so I really like that of just like, you know what, it's not even necessarily like task based. It's not like you're going to get this done today. It's, you have a half hour, let's work on it as much as we can and then go on. I wish I could practice that more, because I think that would be more beneficial for my creative output.
Well, somebody told me once that Graham Greene, who wrote like 80 books or something, he would write 500 words a day. That was it. He would stop in the middle of sentences. He would count and know how many were. And then the next day he would every single day, didn't matter what day. And he wrote 80 books or something like that. And I've always thought about that. It's like, you know, he never had writer's block, because he always, like, if you stopped in the middle of a sentence, you probably know how the rest of it goes. So you can just get going, you know? And that has been super beneficial for me to think about it that way. I do the Pomodoro kind of technique, which is, I mean, technically Pomodoro is 25 minutes, but I do about 45 minutes at a time. And then if I'm really pressed for time, I'll do 30 minutes, but it's, I 100% agree. 1% is more than none percent.
Yeah. Well, and there's that whole, I don't know what it's called, but there's this study that looked at the proportion of like, crap work to masterpieces between like, you know, the great masters and amateurs. And the proportion is essentially the same. It's just that the great masters were much more prolific. So they pumped out 1,000 pieces and 10 of them ended up being really masterful.
Right.
So it's about being in the chair doing the work. Yep. Like a game developer is just someone who makes games consistently, and a writer is just someone who writes consistently. And there's, I mean, maybe there's secret sauce that helps you a little bit along the way, But if you have the sauce and you're not in the kitchen, it's not going to do you any good, right? You have to actually be doing the work.
Yeah, one of my thesis advisors always said you have to have your BIC, which is like, those of you who've not had a pen in your hand recently, a BIC is a pen, but it, she didn't mean a BIC pen. It was her joke. It's your butt in the chair. So it's your BIC. you gotta get the BIC.
Awesome. So I think we need to give our podcast, we need to give each episode a title, and this title needs to be BIC. If you have the sauce but you're not in the kitchen.
That's right. I love that one. Yes, because what's that gonna do you in the front room? Nothing. Yeah. I mean, depends on how good the sauce is, I suppose, but whatever.
Let's get straight.
So what's in the future for Greg? Like, if you could wave a magic wand and, like, you know, are you 5 years from now, are you still making indie games, exploring niche subcultures and things like that? Or what's going to happen in the future? As much as we know what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah.
We'll have a future. It's probably, generally speaking, now that most of us can get vaccinated, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think my games reality and my physical reality are sort of converging in an interesting way, because I just bought a house. So that means that I have my own space to sort of create experiences. And that means that I'm planning on hosting lots of games events.
I was going to say escape room in the future.
Maybe. Well, so I have this this RV garage in back of my house that I'm turning into like an outdoor barcade sort of thing. And I have a dance pole. Just kind of an adult play space. Lowercase adult, but not like.
Well, you did mention a dance pole, so hey, who knows?
I mean, you can take pole dancing classes now as exercise. So I think that that's a little bit broader than that. And they have trapezes and stuff. We have a mutual friend that, you know, does the silks. That's amazing. Yeah. Josh is amazing.
Yeah, he is. But anyway, so I'm excited to like host events and get even more involved with the games community here. As far as Bearded Dragons goes, I'm still working on it. I have some fun developments that I've been kind of pounding through recently, introducing like an announcer system. So I have this this great announcer from New York who's doing all sorts of sassy reads and stuff like that as you're playing.
That sounds great.
And then, you know, just working towards publishing it on the Switch and then on Steam as well. I'm putting together some like publisher pitches right now. And so we'll see if anyone wants to throw money at it. The festival route was sort of delayed because of the pandemic, but those are starting back up again. So as of yesterday, I submitted my first application to a festival, you know, post-pandemic. So that's exciting.
That is.
5 years down the line, I really do think I'll still be making games. I think, you know, I originally started out in games. One of the things I loved most about games was that they were inexpensive to make, in the sense that if you had a computer and power, like, you were good to go. But I find myself more and more drawn to like the intersection of physical spaces and games. And so trying to integrate, alternative controllers, trying to create playful physical spaces that are gameful in their design. I love stuff like that. And so especially as I've been like buying furniture for my new house, I've thought a lot about like, oh, how do I make this space more playful? And, you know, how do I don't know, games are designed spaces, right? So how do I design a space for people to have certain experiences within it, you know? Anyway, that's been really fun. But yeah, I plan on continuing to make games for a long, long time. I have a couple of like patent ideas that I'm gonna be pursuing once I'm done with Bearded Dragons that maybe will make money. If that doesn't make money, then it's my own fault, because like, it's not at all alt. It's not at all weird. Kind of thinking about different ways of distributing games that I think could be interesting.
Oh, fascinating.
That's really cool. And we are, and I don't, this is going to sound like a platitude, but like, Utah's gaming community as a whole is super lucky to have people like you as a part of it. We were talking before the podcast began about, you know, not only the necessity of like diversity and things like that, but just people willing to do fun stuff and people willing to do weird stuff and people willing to kind of break that mold. It's super awesome to have people like you to be like, yeah, we're gonna make a brawler about drag queens and it's gonna be rad because who else, like, who doesn't want that?
Oh, thank you.
I 100% agree. I mean, our community is amazing. So it really is. I'm happy that we have it. It's definitely made my life so much richer, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and it's growing. I mean, I feel like Salt Lake has gone through kind of a few different phases as far as its like games community. You know, there were a lot of jobs that were lost like back in 08, and that mm-hmm. sort of set us back a little bit. But we've had a couple of different smaller collectives formed, and we now have pretty consistent co-working. And so I think the I don't know, the field is ripe, you know. And so
it's just growing, you know. Yeah. And I think a lot of people moving out of big places, coming into, you know, wanting to be in medium-sized cities, and Salt Lake has a lot of benefits and to be here. And I think just in the next few years, we're 100%, sorry. Binging.
I want Connor to time that bing so that it says brought to you by the Salt Lake City Board of Tourism.
Because right?
That's the most perfect pitch ever.
Right. Sorry, I thought everything was turned off, but because I am professional. Anyway, I just think Salt Lake is, we are going to change. And I'm a hopeful, optimistic human that we're going to be attracting a lot of people who are going to have a lot of energy for stuff that we care about. So I'm excited about that. I can't believe we're out of, like, we're getting end of time.
Yeah. Well, can I guess maybe I'll end on one little
idea. We still have rapid fire questions though, but you say whatever you want. Yes. But
like the last thought I want to throw out there is like, you know, Utah has this notion of like the ensign on the hill, you know, like the flag waving for other people to rally around that. And I know traditionally that's been, you know, tied to one culture, but I think in a big way, you know, we get to create whatever future we want for Salt Lake, right? And the reality is that the people who are watching this podcast are going to be the ones waving the ensigns and saying, hey, Salt Lake is the place for queers, and Salt Lake is the place for people of color, and Salt Lake is the place for religious people too. I mean, you know, the community is big enough for all of these voices, but I think the more intentional we are about sort of waving our own flag and showing up as who we are authentically, it's going to create space for other people to also come here and tell their stories and sort of build that community and add their richness to that beautiful melting pot that is Salt Lake City.
Absolutely, absolutely. We do need to fix our air quality, but you know.
Maybe we'll do it with a game, crowdsource.
Why not? Boom. Why not?
There it is.
There's your design challenge, listeners.
Okay, rapid fire question time.
I'm ready. All right,
Greg, what was the first game you remember playing?
Oh, I mean, probably Super Mario Brothers on the SNES.
Mm.
Yeah. Or Super Bases Loaded, one of the two. I had two older brothers.
What was the system, the very first like console system, or maybe it was a PC that you owned, that you bought yourself?
Oh, that I bought myself. It was a computer, yeah, a PC. Mm-hmm. I got an N64 as a birthday present when I was like 11 or something. It was kind of a family gift or whatever. But yeah, first one that I purchased was in college, I think.
We actually have a lot of people say that. They're like, you know, my family had one, but the first one I bought was like a PlayStation 4.
Because... Well, if you were modding Warcraft, I think that makes a lot of sense.
what is your favorite video game of all time and why?
Earthbound is my favorite of all time. And I think it's because it reaches through the fourth wall in ways that shocked and amazed me. So, well, it's an old game, so spoiler alert, but not really.
It's like 32 years old or something like that. I think we're past spoilers at this juncture.
At the very start of the game, it asks you for your character's name. And then it says, and now what's your name? Not you, the character, but you, the person holding the remote, right?
Yeah.
And then for the next 40 hours of gameplay, it doesn't mention your name at all. And you forget that you even ever told it to the game. And then you're in this really beautiful moment. And there's all this writing that's appearing on the wall in sort of bioluminescent hues. And it's talking about how difficult of a journey you've come through and how much you've grown and all that. And then it says, and you, Greg, and starts talking to you directly as the player. And I remember the first time I played through that, I was just stunned. You know, I didn't remember having ever entered my name, but B, it was just like, oh yeah, I'm assuming the role of the character. I've come through this great journey. And then suddenly everything they had been talking about that whole time was about me. Mm-hmm. You know, you've come through so much and you've grown so much. And you know, we're glad you're here, blah, 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 blah. I think Nintendo's always been a little bit experimental in acknowledging the player as a separate entity from the player character, right? You have old games that would say, hey, it looks like you've been playing for a while. Maybe you should turn off the Nintendo and go outside.
Animal Crossing still does that, by the way.
But Earthbound just like, I think it was the first time I ever felt like there was a conscious being behind the game who was speaking to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt really special and really, unique compared to every other game I have played.
I love that. I haven't played that game forever.
Yeah.
I should play that again. Adam got me to play Chrono Trigger because I'd never played it. And now I'm like, I want to play Chrono Trigger again.
Yeah, just play all those old RPGs. No. Golden age.
Right. What is a game that, any game at all, that you wish you could have worked on?
That's a good one. Last of Us is one of my faves. I love that.
Did you play 2? Last of Us 2?
Yeah, yeah.
What'd you think?
You know, opinions. I liked Ellie a lot better in number one than I did.
Maybe we should not be recording this part. We could talk about that later.
No, but I think League of Legends is something I've always loved. And I've always thought it was like such an interesting design like challenge. And I think especially because it rose out of the like the Warcraft 3 world editor days. Like I saw it when it was in its very infancy and loved it back then. And it's just been this crazy transformation over the years. And I've always thought like, oh, what would it be like to jump into that, you know?
Yeah, I can see that.
Who is your favorite Pokemon?
That's hard. Maybe Dragonair. Yeah, it's kind of a bizarre one.
I was gonna say, that's one we've never heard before.
I mean, Adam knows all of them, but...
Well, no, but I did have to drop out of calculus because I was playing Pokemon too much on a Game Boy, so...
Well, at least it was for a good reason.
See, that's what I'm saying, right? We had a substitute come in for like 3 weeks while our teacher was on like maternity leave or something, and he was explaining what derivatives were, for those of you who know calculus, and... my buddy had lent me his Game Boy. He's like, hey, you got to catch them all. And I was like, oh my gosh, you do have to catch them all. And then like 3 weeks later, she comes back and she gives us a test. And I have no idea what anything is because I wasn't paying any attention. So
I can't believe the substitute did not notice that you had a Game Boy in your hands.
Just like, right, you have it. And then
like, I get like, it, but teachers are not dumb.
Well, maybe he just didn't care. Like many substitutes.
Yes, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So, okay. So imagine if you will, you have just won the biggest lottery of all time. You have so much money that you could make any kind of game in the world. Start your own studio, hire all the people. What would you make?
Ooh, I mean, probably some ridiculous RPG. Like, I love the Final Fantasy games growing up. I mean, I still love them. I just don't have time to play them anymore. Right. But, yeah, probably, yeah, like Final Fantasy 20 or something.
Just buy Square and we'll be good.
You did say like the biggest lotteries.
So I did. Somebody. Well,
the entire development studio will be on a houseboat. So that'll
right. that would be a really awesome studio, like just on Lake Powell, like all the houseboats all the way around.
Well, I've thought about it.
That's what there needs to be. Like, you know how there's some like people who like, I took a cross-country train from Seattle to New York and I wrote this short story or whatever. It needs to be like, we put a game development team on a ship that went from California to Japan and back. And what did they come up with over the course of
train,
that?
Like, they have train jams to go to GDC. I mean, back in the before times. So
I did not know
but that. I haven't ever heard of like a trans-Pacific game jam.
Yes.
Same.
There's probably a market for that.
We could make it happen.
We know some people in that are making games in Japan, so they could probably like get on and then come and finish it while or something on their way back. I could see this. I could see this working.
What games are you playing right now? Not right now, but generally speaking. Are you playing Pokemon on the Game Boy right now? Is that what's happening here?
Yeah, sorry about that.
I just got my League on my phone over here.
Nice. So always League of Legends because I'm addicted to it and it's just like my go-to. I don't have to think, but it makes me feel like I'm achieving something. And as well as Teamfight Tactics, which is their mobile game. I've been playing Horizon Zero Dawn a little bit, and then Ark Survival Evolved is another favorite that just draws me back over and over and over. So
I haven't played that. I should look at that.
But with dinosaurs that you can tame.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of ridiculous. You'll just be wandering around and then some guy on a T-Rex will come over and, you know, completely gore you to death.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds, that reminds me of Tomb Raider back in the day. Yeah. I love that. I am playing Valhalla. Well, I stopped because I got an email from Sony that told me how many hours I'd played. I'm like, yeah, I'm over this.
Yeah, I just don't look at Steam for stuff like that. You know, it's like, oh, you played 100.
I know. That's actually one of the problems with Stardew Valley. Stop telling me. Stop telling me. I don't need to know. Crazy. And the final question that we ask everybody is, if you could give someone who is just starting out on their journey making games, or maybe you could go back in time and give, I'd say little Greg, but you've been tall for a million years, right? So if you could give yourself advice or someone that's starting, what would be your biggest piece of advice?
Well, I think the biggest piece would be the reason you got into games was to be with people and so that you could connect with people. And don't let the making games get in the way of connecting with people. You know,
oh, I love that.
Like there's this whole I don't know, just a weird relationship where you're sitting at home coding so that other people will have joy, so that they'll like you and see the world in a similar way as you see it. But that's also an isolating experience, you know? I forget who wrote the song. I want to say probably Sondheim, but there's a song about finishing the hat, right? He's painting a painting and he's standing by the window painting this hat, trying to finish the hat so he can go outside and, you know, see the people who he's painting. And there's this weird like dissonance where you're separated, but you are so committed to those people who you're making the game for. You're trying to create a beautiful experience for them. You're trying to connect with them. You're trying to, you know, help them have a fun time, but you're stuck at home. I think my advice for myself is like, you know, still make the game, still be consistent about that, but also like, you got to live your life. That's why you're doing it. You know, you got to get out there. You got to, meet the people, you gotta hear the stories so that you can then transform them into something beautiful. And a lot of times it won't be the sitting there coding that changes your perspectives on things. It'll be that person who says, hey, you do a lot of thinking about games, maybe you should do a master's program, you know, or it'll be a person at the Sam Arcade in Washington, D.C., who just changes the way you view the world. And that makes all the difference, you know. Two roads diverged in a wood.
Yep. I love that. That's such good advice, Greg. Such good advice. And we are so lucky that you are teaching our students, because you, I love how centered you are. I have gotten to see you get there, you know, and I'm so excited to see where you go, because I love how you think. I love you. And thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been so fun being on here. So
it goes
you.
By like that, huh?
I know. Yeah, it was every very time. Fun.
It's weird. It's really weird. Okay, I'm gonna.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.